Good morning. This is Neil Strausser with the CBS World News Roundup. Murderer, murderer, the shouts in San Francisco as thousands of demonstrators protested, some violently. A jury's finding that former city supervisor Dan White was guilty of voluntary manslaughter, not first-degree murder, in the killings of Mayor George Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk, an avowed homosexual. The evidence showed that White, unhappy because Moscone refused to give him back the job he had resigned, shot the mayor four times, reloaded his gun, and shot Milk five times. But the jury agreed with defense testimony that he was suffering a mental collapse, a verdict that could see White a free man within 5 years. And that brought the protesters, many of them homosexuals themselves, to City Hall. Harold Dow reports.
The demonstrators shouted slogans protesting what they considered the injustice of the verdict. There were more than 4,000 of them. Tensions were high. They shouted and screamed and finally rioted, breaking windows in City Hall and surrounding buildings. They pounded on doors. They threw bricks and bottles and burned police cars. Hundreds of riot-equipped police officers began a counter-assault, forcing the demonstrators away from the front steps of City Hall. Some of the protesters were injured in the exchange. Blood could be seen on the heads and faces of some of them. But most of the injured were police officers, hit with flying bricks or bottles. The streets in front of San Francisco City Hall looked like the aftermath of a war zone. But the most damaging result of last night's riot was not visible. The credibility of the gay community may have also been destroyed. Something that took years to establish, one police officer said, disappeared in a few hours. Harold Dow, CBS News, San Francisco.
A first-degree conviction for White could have meant a death penalty. In Florida, only the federal courts now stand between two convicts and the electric chair tomorrow, Bruce Hall reports.
John Spinkelink and Willie Darden have lost a series of last-minute appeals in state and federal courts, increasing the chances they will be executed Wednesday morning. They will make final appeals to the U.S. Supreme Court, but that court has already turned down Spinkelink four times. Death penalty opponents are continuing their around-the-clock vigil at the state capitol in Tallahassee, and demonstrators are scheduled to begin gathering later today at the Florida State Prison near Stark. Inside the prison, Spinkelink and Darden have been moved to cells near the electric chair. The prison superintendent says they are becoming apprehensive, but still believe they will get a stay of execution. But apparently their only hope rests with the courts, as state officials say they will take no action to halt the executions. Bruce Hall, CBS News, at the Florida State Prison.
The executions, if carried out, would be the first in Florida since 1964 and the first in the U.S. since Gary Gilmore went before a firing squad in Utah in January 1977. In Canada, as in Britain a few weeks ago, it's the Liberals versus the Conservatives. But the feeling is the voters may give the balance of power to a small third party, the Socialist New Democrats, in today's parliamentary elections. Steve Young has more from Toronto.
Liberal Party leader Pierre Elliott Trudeau in final campaign appearances argued that Canada needs to gain full charge of its destiny and eliminate Britain's influence on Canadian constitutional affairs. One skeptic said the subject of constitutional patriation, as Trudeau calls it, is somewhat less important to most Canadians than Dutch elm disease. It left people wondering if Trudeau expects to lose and wants to go out on a lofty issue. Conservative candidate Joe Clark's aides feel confident that despite polls showing it's neck and neck, Clark will win at least a plurality of the seats in Parliament. Accordingly, Clark cut back the number of his appearances in the closing days of the campaign to avoid the possibility of any last-minute gaffe. Many people are going to the polls this morning unhappy with Trudeau, unsure about Clark, and worried by problems ranging from the survival of the country itself to soaring inflation and the sinking value of Canada's dollar. Canadians are expected to vote in a government controlling only a minority of the seats in Parliament, a government that would have a hard time dealing with those challenges in the months ahead. Steve Young, CBS News, Toronto.
In London, Secretary of State Vance continues his get-acquainted sessions with members of Britain's new Conservative government. Bob McNamara reports.
This afternoon, Vance has talks with Francis Pym. Pym, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's defense secretary. Vance is expected to brief Pym on the U.S. and Soviet Union's SALT II agreement, a pact which Britain has endorsed, but one that has caused some European military strategists to fear that Europe might be left vulnerable to medium-range Russian missiles. Last night, the Secretary of State hosted a private dinner for Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and several other top officials of her government. Earlier in the day, after long talks with Foreign Secretary Lord Carrington, Vance won assurances from Carrington that Britain would not rush to recognize the new government in Rhodesia, nor would it immediately lift economic sanctions against the country. And the pledge, in effect, will give the White House the first chance to make any major shift in policy towards Rhodesia. Bob McNamara, CBS News, London.
Israel's Prime Minister Begin flew to London today for talks with Vance before he meets at the end of this week with Egyptian President Sadat. Begin, as he left Israel, disputing an Egyptian government statement that the Israeli-Egyptian border will remain closed even after the return this week of the Sinai desert town of El Arish. Begin saying the matter will be clarified when he meets with Sadat. And now the good news for once. It comes to us from Southern California and Terry Drinkwater in Los Angeles.
California, the place where it all began, may be experiencing the beginning of the end of the current gas crisis. Yesterday, the lines were appreciably shorter. And today, an even day in the allocation program, officials predict shorter waits, perhaps 15 minutes, and in some places, no waits at all. The reasons? Slightly less driving. Some fuel-conscious economical driving. Deliveries to big stations of a little bit more fuel as state emergency supplies are released to the public. Then, too, the refiners, anticipating the White House decision for more gas to California next month, are speeding up their deliveries now. Attendants report less topping off. There's a tendency for motorists to plan ahead now because more stations are posting their hours, though most all of the hours still remain limited. Newspaper, television, and radio stations aren't emphasizing the story as much. That also may have lessened the panic. But, said one editorialist this morning, we hope Californians have learned their lesson. The lines may be shorter, but the gas crisis isn't over. It never will be. Terry Drinkwater, CBS News, Los Angeles.
Elsewhere, there is still concern about supplies this coming holiday weekend, though Ohio says most of its stations will be open in Ohio, and New York predicts tight but adequate supplies of gasoline. Today in Washington, more testimony about the finances of Senator Herman Talmadge before the Senate Ethics Committee from his former administrative aide, Daniel Minshew. Phil Jones reports.
Minshew was Talmadge's administrative assistant from 1971 through 74. He has already testified that Talmadge complained about the high cost of being a senator, and as a result, there was a discussion on how to increase available funds. One option, according to Minshew, was to open a secret bank account to handle the Senate funds and campaign contributions. And Minshew claims that Talmadge was aware of the decision to go ahead with a secret bank account. Talmadge claims he knew nothing about this and that he never benefited from any such account. Minshew has admitted taking some of the secret account money for his personal use, but he claims that he did not get all of it. Another issue is Talmadge's daily spending money. Talmadge claims he operated on $5 and $10 cash gifts from friends. But Minshew says that it was not unusual for Talmadge to have $100 bills in his pocket. Testimony is expected later from Talmadge's former wife about some $7,700 in $100 bills that she found in the senator's overcoat. Phil Jones, CBS News, Capitol Hill.
In Atlanta, Robert Shackney has observed activity suggesting a federal grand jury considering the banking activities of Burt Lance may soon decide whether to indict the former budget director and close friend of President Carter.
Federal agents were seen entering and leaving the grand jury room with computer records and other documents, and a further grand jury meeting is scheduled today. Lance has retained an attorney to represent him in a possible criminal case. The nature of the case against Lance is already on public record. A year ago, in a non-criminal proceeding, the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Comptroller of the Currency accused Lance of fraud and deceit for his activities as president of two Georgia banks in his hometown of Calhoun and in Atlanta. Among the charges, that Lance improperly arranged loans for himself, his relatives, and his business associates. This grand jury will not deal with Lance's loans to the Carter family's peanut warehouse. That investigation has been taken over by an independent special counsel. Robert Shackney, CBS News, Atlanta.
Those boycotting Texas state senators still haven't been found, but even if they are, Lieutenant Governor William Hobby is conceding they probably have won their fight against a separate presidential primary they feel would benefit Republican John Connally and conservative Democrats. The bill, Hobby says, now seems dead in the state Senate. Good morning. This is Neil Strausser with the CBS World News Roundup. The final unofficial results are in Canada's parliamentary elections. Joe Clark's Conservatives, 20-seat victors over Pierre Trudeau's Liberals, but still short of a clear majority. 16 years of liberal leadership are at an end, but because of the voting pattern, the conservative victory also seems to pose a new threat to Canada's already tattered unity. Steve Young has more from Toronto.
When it became clear that Conservative leader Joe Clark had won control of a minority of Parliament, Liberal Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau faced his followers earlier this morning and conceded defeat.
I think it is my duty at this time to recommend to my colleagues that we hand the government over. As for me, I think I will be a pretty good leader of the opposition, surrounded as I am.
Soon after, 39-year-old Joe Clark, who will be Canada's youngest prime minister, addressed a jubilant crowd in Spruce Grove, Alberta.
We have achieved, and we have achieved together, a victory for change in this country, and that is what we are together going to achieve.
The election return shows a Canada split in two more sharply than ever before. Trudeau won an overwhelming victory in French-speaking Quebec, but was wiped out in English Canada. Talking in French, Clark sought to sue the people of Quebec, whose government is pledged to holding a referendum on whether the province should separate from the rest of the nation.
Le Québec ne se sentira pas isolé.
Quebec will not feel isolated in a Clark government.
Quebec's separatist premier, René Lévesque, whose hand appears to be strengthened by Clark's victory, is expected to comment on the national election outcome before the Quebec National Assembly later today. Steve Young, CBS News, Toronto.
Margaret Trudeau followed the election returns at a New York apartment and went discoing at Manhattan Studio 54, where she told reporters she plans to go back to Canada to visit her estranged husband and predicted Pierre Trudeau will be the best opposition leader known to the world. The two executions which have been scheduled this morning at the Florida State Prison are not taking place. A stay for one convict came yesterday afternoon, for the second not until about midnight, as Sam Ford reports from the prison.
Some of the 200 demonstrators at the Florida State Prison sang the hymn Amazing Grace this morning after they learned that 30-year-old John Spinkeling's execution had been stayed. He had been scheduled to die at 7 a.m. Eastern Time. But before the announcement, the demonstrators chanted angry slogans, while inside, prison inmates started fires by throwing burning paper into the hallways. The extent of the damage is not known, but prison officials called in at least one rescue unit. The prison superintendent said approximately one-third of the 1,500 inmates refused meals yesterday to protest the scheduled executions of Spinkelink and 45-year-old Willie Darden. A federal judge in Tampa granted Darden a stay of execution yesterday afternoon. Spinkelink got a reprieve from both the U.S. Supreme Court's Justice Thurgood Marshall and Judge Elbert Tuttle of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. If the courts have not resolved the Spinkelink case by noon Friday, the current death warrant against him expires, and the governor of Florida will have to sign a new one. Sam Ford, CBS News, at the Florida State Prison.
What happens now? A report from CBS News law correspondent Fred Graham in Washington.
Justice Thurgood Marshall's stay of execution for John Spinkelink is expected to be short-lived. The votes are simply not there on the Supreme Court for opponents of capital punishment, and the full court will probably overturn Justice Marshall's stay today or tomorrow. But meanwhile, Court of Appeals Judge Elbert Tuttle in Atlanta was granting Spinkelink a stay on a new legal point, the allegation that the condemned murderer did not have adequate counsel at his trial. That issue will be quickly considered by the Court of Appeals, and so Spinkelink's case could be back before the Supreme Court, for the fifth time this time, by next week. Spinkelink's lawyers would then be able to try again, the kind of justice shopping that saw them go to two justices last night before they found a third, Justice Marshall, who was willing to grant a stay. It's certain that the opponents of capital punishment will make every effort to keep Spinkelink from the electric chair because he would be the first unwilling prisoner to be executed in this country in 12 years, and that could touch off a chain of executions across the United States. Fred Graham, CBS News, Washington.
In San Francisco, where the Rocks flew the night before in protest to the manslaughter conviction of Dan White, voices raised in song last night as the gay community turned out again. David Dow reports.
From the beginning, the message was nonviolent. For weeks, San Francisco's gay community had planned the observance of what would have been the 49th birthday of City County Supervisor Harvey Milk, an avowed homosexual killed with Mayor George Moscone last November. And organizers were determined that it not become a rerun of Monday's violent demonstration. It did not. Thousands, estimates range from 5 to 15,000, jammed a street in the heart of the gay community for the birthday party. Police were on alert, but out of sight, leaving crowd control to monitors from the community. Speakers lamented Monday's violence, but Milk's successor, Harry Britt, said they should not apologize for it.
Let no one believe that the step that we have taken is a step from nonviolence to violence.
Right.
We have suffered too much with the hands of violent people.
At the end, the same streets that had launched Monday's angry protest produced nothing more violent than a street dance lasting until midnight. David Dow, CBS News, San Francisco.
To the cheers of some and the boos of others, those 12 most wanted state senators have ended their boycott and returned to the Texas State Senate, confident they've won their fight against separating presidential primaries in Texas. In advance of new talks with Egypt, new violence, a bomb blast inside Israel today. Dan Revive reports.
A woman and her baby girl were killed in the explosion at a bus stop in Petah Tikva, a suburb of Tel Aviv. At least 12 other people were wounded. Security officials say they believe this was the work of Palestinian terrorists who are protesting Israel's peace treaty with Egypt and violently rejecting the autonomy offered to Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. Israel and Egypt begin their talks on setting up autonomy the day after tomorrow. Also on Friday, Israel will hand the largest town in the Sinai, El Arish, back to Egyptian control. There are still some unresolved questions, such as when the new border at El Arish will be open to civilian traffic. There's also the matter of about 100 Israeli settlers in the northern Sinai who are sitting in, refusing to vacate a 500-acre field, which is also to go back to Egypt on Friday. The settlers shouted insults at Defense Minister Ezer Weitzman when he went to the field today to ask them to leave. Weitzman left without even completing a sentence. He then joined the talks in El Arish between Foreign Minister Moshe Dayan and Egypt's Minister of State Boutros Ghali. They're trying to make the first transfer of occupied territory as part of peace as smooth as possible. Dan Revive for CBS News, Tel Aviv.
In San Salvador, reporters have counted the bodies of 14 men, women, and children killed when police opened fire on their procession last night. They were attempting to take food to leftists holding the Venezuelan embassy in El Salvador's capital. Police say they were fired upon first, but leftists deny it. United Airlines is now planning ahead again, looking to win back its passengers, and has asked for approval of $108 one-way fares for some of its coast-to-coast flights. But first must come the machinist union vote today and tomorrow on ending the 52-day-old strike, as Robert Jordan reports from Chicago.
This is the third contract vote for the rank-and-file members of the machinist union. Two previous tentative agreements were rejected. The present settlement calls for a 30% increase in pay over a three-year period and new fringe benefits. This has been the longest strike in the history of United, reportedly costing the airline over $1 million a day. Major tourist areas serviced by United have been hardest hit. Hawaii reportedly lost $35 million in revenue during the month of April. And passengers in many small towns found travel difficult, sometimes impossible, without frequent and convenient air transportation. If during the next 2 days of balloting, the union ratifies the contract, then United could begin limited service by the first of next week, with full service expected a week to 10 days later. Robert Jordan, CBS News, Chicago.
House Democratic leaders headed off a revolt within President Carter's own party today. They used the clock to stall, at least until tomorrow, a House Democratic caucus vote opposing President Carter's decision to lift oil price controls. Five House Democrats today are announcing a nationwide campaign to draft Senator Edward Kennedy as the 1980 nominee. Kennedy says no thanks, but the Democrats say they'll press on.